your choice. You can listen to this, or you can go home and read my little, what would we call this? Historical fiction, possibly. What's left of my memory. But this is a really fun story, and it was wonderful that Connie asked me last fall it was to write about the piano drop here in Doodle. A lot of you may or may not be familiar with the piano drop, but it's kind of a long story, and you'll probably be here for a couple hours and wish you'd stay at home tonight by the time I'm done. I'm probably a bit better storyteller than I am a writer, so you have a little bit of both. And these are intended to be basically kind of rough drafts of something I would like to leave with a historical society. Maybe someday it'll be in a psychedelic version of the Wagon Wheel. But it's about an interesting day in the history of Duval, history which is about 100 and some years old. But boy, I beat around the bush. I'm a talker, so bear with me. The piano drop was an event, a musical event in Duval. It took place in April of 1968. But to really appreciate or kind of understand what this was about, I'm going to have to kind of talk about the hippie invasion of Duval, because the piano drop was related to this cultural phenomena. But before we go there, you kind of got to go back and sort of set the stage as to why this event. Well, it's like an earthquake. You know, they don't last long, but they affect a lot of things for a long time. They sort of reset the course of history to some degree. In 1968, Duval was a really sleepy little burg, and it was a place where the population had probably declined from the 20s, and it really wasn't a bedroom community of Seattle yet. There was a lot happening in the 60s, and in 68, I mean, there was some real things that led up to this. Duval and its culture were very rural, kind of backwater. Duval hadn't changed much in terms of culture. I mean, 68, 67 through 69, there were a lot of things happening. I mean, a lot of these things had really started before the Second World War and really sort of fell into place after the Second World War. And that being kind of a cultural revolution where you had people like Jack Kerouac, the early beatniks that wrote On the Road. You had Che Guevara, the Motorcycle Diaries. Guys like Ginsberg, Howell. There was a sexual revolution that had slowly kind of fallen into place. Rock and roll came on the scene. You had Elvis and that thing happening, and 1968 was a time where there was really a shift in terms of consciousness. I mean, Mr. Reed was my teacher in eighth grade. He was, God, he looks younger than me now. How is that possible? You know, but anyway, it was a time of evolution, revolution. And, you know, I'm looking back at this as a guy that's in his mid-50s, very middle-aged, with grandkids, trying to remember what it was like when I was 15. So I was sort of, the narrative sort of tells you where I was coming from at the time. Maybe a little bit too revealing on a personal level, but again, to go back, you've got to kind of look at, you know, what was going on. I mean, Duval was a really different place. Seattle was a different place. There were very different cultures as they are now, but I think even more so then. I mean, most of the people, Ray was living here, had been here most of his life, and, you know, I mean, the 60s were a turbulent time. You had the Vietnam War going on. You had people in Seattle protesting it. You know, people out here sent their kids off to the army pretty much understood. That's what redneck kids did. You had the civil rights movement going on. They were burning Watts Ghetto in Los Angeles, where in Duval there were no black people. And I mean, I think Mr. Reed will remember the first black kid I went to school with. That didn't happen. We were in, I think, eighth grade. A kid named Bob Whitlock came to Canyon Park. And he was from the group home in Bothell. And I mean, It was a time he was, I don't know how old he was, but he was a lot tougher than us. He certainly starred on our football team. And somebody, I think one of the kids asked Mr. Holmes, our coach, whether we could all stand in line and touch Bob's head. I mean, you don't do things like that. No, this is the truth. I mean, it was a time where, okay, again, back in 68, it was 5 years after Kennedy's death, and that was a milestone, or another huge shift in the American consciousness. The country was never the same after that. So, anyway, to make a long story short, this was, you know, the sort of the summer of love, the hippie thing had came to Seattle, and it had already been in San Francisco for a while. Now, I was 15, and, you know, at the time, lived in Woodinville, and, geez, we had black and white television, 3 stations, 4, 5, 7, and if you were lucky, 11. We had 10 party lines out here. You know, ours was 2 longs and a short. You had nothing better to do than listen to, like, Candy Clark's conversations with her boyfriend down the road. So anyway, there's all of these things happening, and okay, I'm pretty hip to what's going on. I'm listening to music. I mean, the Beatles were everybody's favorite band, but they were getting kind of old-fashioned. There was something new happening in San Francisco, and Tim Leary was writing books like Tune In, Drop In, Drop Out, and, you know, you could just sort of sense that something big was on the horizon. So, it's spring of 68, I'm going to Canyon Park Junior High, track season. After track, we all went down to the ranch drive, and I'm walking up Main Street in Bothell, and Wilkerson's jewelry store window is a poster for the Piano Drop with Country Joe and the Fish. Now, Country Joe and the Fish, for those that didn't know, were a cult band from San Francisco. They were the avant-garde, the new wave of the Birds, the Jefferson Airplane, the Grateful Dead, bands that are still big today for us oldies but moldies, middle-aged people. You know, those of you that have kids probably remember. And I mean, things were happening at the UW. Tom Gunn was the class president, and they were closing down I-5 with anti-war things. They were selling a magazine called The Helix on the Ave, and, well, gosh, I gotta say, Walt Crowley's funeral was last month. That was sort of another timely part of this, and him and Paul Dorpat, I went to his funeral. It was sort of interesting to see who was left and what they're doing. I was shocked. But anyway, back to the Piano Drop, okay? To talk about the Piano Drop, you've got to do a little bit of background and talk about a guy named Larry Vanover, who was sort of the Pied Piper of the hippies that sort of brought this thing to Duval. Larry was from Seattle. He was one of the guys that was one of the first hippies. He knew a lot of people, knew Dorpat, knew Crawley, hung around with these guys. He ran a pirate radio station called Crab off Queen Anne Hill. And he was a cultural giant. And anyway, him and Dorpat, these guys got together and said, you know, let's have a concert, a music venue, someplace rural, and we're going to drop this piano. And the whole piano thing was, at the time, again, there was another kind of a subtitle here, and that was drugs. Back in the 60s, drug culture was a lot different than it is now. It wasn't a bunch of, like, creepy people up in Vancouver. You know, I mean, these were college professors. People were smoking marijuana. LSD at the time hadn't even been legalized yet. It was too new. No one, you know. And so anyway, a lot of this music and culture and all of this was sort of based on sort of some of this fringe lunacy. So they were going to have this music concert with Country Joe and the Fish and drop this piano from a helicopter, and it's supposed to explode. And if you ate acid, you could watch the sounds vibrate from this thing. And I go on in detail about the whole event. But anyway, Country Joe and the Fish are coming to Duval, and I'm excited. And, you know, gosh, my folks, I couldn't dare tell them I was going to go to the piano drop, so I kind of told my folks, well, I'm going to go to Norm's and see if I can get a summer job lined up. And, you know, God, if I had kind of luck, Norm will have some. I might be a little late, so, you know, don't worry about me. And before I knew it, I was down at the end of Mink Road where I lived, thumbing my way to Duval. And, I mean, from my perspective, it was like all these hippies were driving by, just vans and all kinds of people with long hair, which today, I mean, you look at those old pictures of the Beatles. Christ, don't you wish your kids looked that straight and cute these days? But boy, in its time, having hair over your ears was something a little bit scary. I mean, I'm fifth generation, the first high school grad on my dad's side of the family. I lived in a redneck family. You know, so you just, that wasn't the kind of thing my folks had a lot of tolerance for. I was like, you want to wear? You go out and pick rocks in the yard before you go to something like that. I didn't have my license, which made it particularly difficult, as it says in the essay. You know, life started when you lived out here, when you got your license. I mean, without your license, you were just, it was a long way. I mean, the nearest place to get a candy bar was either Duval or Max Corner, where I lived. And, you know, your feet were sore. You'd need two candy bars by the time you got back home. So anyway, I mean, I'm kind of stuck, you know what I mean? I'm kind of between, again, being 15, I'm really kind of a kid, yet I want to be cool and do all this stuff. I'm not quite old enough to go to the piano drop, you know what I mean? The average guy up there at the time was probably 19. You know, these people were a lot older than me. And so anyway, I go to the Mink Road, stick out my thumb. 20 minutes later, these gals in the Volkswagen bus pick me up and we're heading to the piano drop. And I mean, I didn't get to Duval, but I wasn't sure where the piano drop was. But there were so many cars, it wasn't very difficult. You just kept following the car in front of you. And these gals were real hippies. I'd never really seen real hippies before. I mean, they had the dresses and, you know, the music and the incense. And, you know, I thought they were just darling. They were braless. They had hair under their arms. And it was just, you know, I didn't know what to think. But anyway, I mean, I'm just, you know, I'm a kid, and I'm really liking this whole thing. So we wind our way up Cherry Valley Road, and, you know, I'm kind of lost, but hell, they kind of expect me to know where they're going. And they're from Frisco, and they're playing 8-track tapes of the Moby Grape, and, you know, I mean, I'm on cloud 9. So takes about an hour and a half to get from Mink Road up to Larry's place, which is in the hairpin up on Mount View Road. And I, at the time, hadn't met Larry Vanover yet, so a lot of this, in retrospect, is, you know, I mean, you learned a lot more as you went on in life, and now I'm looking back, God, two generations later, trying to sort this out of my head. But anyway, we get out of the car, we walk up, you can hear the music, and, you know, and I feel pretty geeky. I've got short hair, I'm working on some sideburns, and, you know, these girls are just like, man, they're like angels from heaven to me. I'm just following them around. And so we get there, and there's, I mean, thousands of people. I mean, this place wasn't used to something like that. I mean, it was like, what the hell is going on this morning? And it was a Sunday. And so we get there, and these guys, they're talking about, you know, the piano drop, and they're going to eat acid. And they'd ask me, have you ever eaten acid? And I kind of, sure. So anyway, we finally get there, and I'd never seen a crowd like this. I'm from a pretty straight family, and, you know, Woodinville, and I mean, there's all, and this is like just a carnival. And we get there, it's $3 or $4 or $5, you know, for the gate, and the bands are playing, and there's a guy standing there with a top hat and a tuxedo, and on his hat it says LIDS, which at the time was Mexican marijuana, LSD, $3. He's got this change machine. You know, so I weighed into my pocket. I'll figure it out. Let me in the concert. So anyway, the band's there, and everybody having a drink. I'm with the girls, and before you know it, time sort of stops, and the clouds are looking a little different. You know what I mean? The time-space warp was upon me, and the band's playing, and I'm just into the music, and I'm going, I mean, it was worse than that. It was really kind of intimidating, because Mr. Hill, I don't know if you remember this, but they had this health film, and it talked about LSD, and the first kid that tried it was looking at a bird out of a window and tried to fly and fell to his death, and the next kid was looking at, like, one of those little, like, burners, you know, on a stove, and it turned into a flower, so he tried to pick it. So, I mean, I had a lot of reason to be a bit suspicious of this, but the girl said, oh, no, this is really important, because you can understand the music. Unless you're on acid, you don't get the message. And, You're missing the whole point of this. And of course, in retrospect, this is all complete tripe. But at the time, and this is like, you know, Bigfoot or something, you didn't know whether to believe it or not. But I mean, you were listening to all this kooky music, like, you know, Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds. You have to wonder what the L, Lucy, S, Sky, D, Diamonds hidden message was. And, you know, it was, if you played the Beatles records backwards, you would hear things like the Walrus and Paul. And it was hard, you know, there was a lot of voodoo going on at the time, but, you know, more importantly, it looked like a lot of fun. So, anyway, this band's playing away, and everybody's quite a bit older than me, and out of the west comes this helicopter. It looked like a dragonfly. And there's all these people just, wow, watching this thing, and it just lands right, and the crowd opens up magically, and these guys come out and they hook up this piano, and it takes off, and it's just swinging back and forth. That, you know, even as an eighth grader, I knew something was wrong with this picture. And so this thing goes up in the sky and releases this piano, and it was just, from my perspective, I mean, a bit addled, possibly. It was hard to tell whether the piano was falling or whether the helicopter was moving away from it, but this thing, it's like time stopped as it just sort of went down, and I'm expecting to see this incredible cacophony of sound and light, and it landed in the mud with a and we were just waiting for it. And I mean, worse than that, I kept thinking about what the girls were saying, and all I could hear was the roar of this damn helicopter. I mean, talk about mystic vibrations. I really felt rather ripped off. And I mean, the crowd was silent. Just, I mean, it was sort of like that, you know, then all of a sudden a dog barked and the crowd kind of went, started moving. Give a Country Joe and the Fish, who were, again, a really interesting band. Country Joe grabbed the microphone and said, "Well, looks like they'll have to try that one again." And again, they break into one of their anti-war songs or something, and the party went on, you know what I mean? It was like, well. So everybody, I just sort of wandered around, and people instantly, like, just sort of like simians came up to the site where the piano landed. They were afraid at first, you know, just seeing the helicopter still making a lot of noise, and people started packing off parts of the piano. I ran across a couple guys I knew named Bob Silk and Greg Lonas, and Greg had like a leg of the piano, and God, what a treasure. I tried to get a hold of Greg just last week to see whether he still had it, but you talk to people, and you're like, anyways, the piano drop? Yeah? Yeah. Greg would rather forget some of these memories.
A lot of things Greg would rather forget.
So anyway, the funny thing about this is, okay, at the time, there were all these San Francisco bands kind of worked this West Coast music thing, and the place where all the concerts that were good in Seattle, before the outside venue thing happened, was a place called Eagles Auditorium. It's on, like, I don't know, 6th and James Street, and all these, that's where we went every Saturday. We'd always go, we're going to go up to the cabin this weekend, and straight to Eagles Auditorium, you know, hang out all night. But anyway, back to Greg, they had these light shows by what was called the Retina Circus Light Show, and they were, with the music, they had these just really hokey projector sets where they put, like, pictures, like, on Mylar, and would shake water with oil blobs on it on the stage when these bands were playing, and like the Grateful Dead, it was all part of the psychedelic thing, and somehow Lonas got his picture in their archives, and it would be like Greg and Bob on the stage for the next 2 or 3 years, like, look, Bob, it's you, and I just felt so robbed that they didn't take my picture, too. It's like, they were famous, and I mean, we're in junior high back in the day, and I mean, we're still tucking our shirts in, and it was, yes, Mr. Reed, Mr. Holmes, I mean, you know, you just, it was back when you had a lot of respect for your teachers and stuff. I mean, you know, so if you're going to be a hippie, it had to be on the weekend during those days. They wouldn't even let you have long hair. In fact, we went to Canyon Park. It's a great story. Mike will remember this. One kid had long hair. His name was Paul. I forget his
yeah.
And anyway, coach.
And his parents sued the school district.
Oh, it's such a great story. We're in football, and the coaches, we just don't home, so say, you know, I don't know about you guys, but when I went to school, if some guy had hair like a girl, you know what we do? Somebody would take the scissors out. So a couple guys, Sharp and Rusty, decide to grab Paul the next day and give him a haircut, and they did. And there was, well, the football team, please come to the gym. All of the members of the football team. And they kind of said, I'm like, look, guys, we have a problem here. The press is here. If anybody says a word about us, say anything about that, you'll never play in a football game in the North Shore School District again. No.
That's Bob Knorr, who became the yeah. personnel director.
It was one of those, like, somebody's going to have to do the right thing and stand up and say they did this. So I was like, of course we will.
Yeah.
And in front of the press, I was like, what made you kids think of this? Oh, I don't know. It's just, didn't like his long hair, sir. You know, but it was one of those cover-ups. You couldn't pull that today if you tried. But anyway, kind of back to the different times. Back. This is before man had even been on the moon. Back to the piano drop. Anyway, it's just a great story. You know, it's just a super fun music, kind of a watershed event in my life. And it was a real shift in consciousness, boy. Like, so I hitchhike home. The girls had finally found more sophisticated company. I think Bob and everybody, his sister Wanda, had a car, so I got a ride back to the end of the Mink Road. And by the time I got home, it was dark and rainy, kind of misty, because it was colder than heck. And I'm kind of shaking as I come up the driveway. And it was like scenes from like the Bega Bay, the birds, just the house, you know. And I knock on the door, and it just kind of like, you didn't stay out late when I was a kid either, you know, without calling your folks up, you know. There was, you'd better pay for that spanking's worth. So I kind of, I lived in this trailer, like, off of my parents' place at the time. I kind of moved in there, and I was like, hey, I'm home. Silence from the back room here. They went, Gus, is that you? Yeah, Dad. Where the hell have you been? And it kind of caught me off guard, so all I could say was, on acid. Wheels of fire rolling through the window. God, there's another silence. My dad goes, wheels of fire in my ass! I'm gonna be to work at 6 o'clock in the morning! What the hell's wrong with you? Did you get the job? You're gonna buy your school clothes next year, damn it! And this is like during the Seattle, like the downturn, Boeing had just fired everybody, so the old man's worried about money, you know, and I'm kind of on a whole different plane that night. So I go to bed, got up the next morning, and caught the bus, the big yellow bus, back to Canyon Park. And life was really never the same after that. Things really went downhill. But, I mean, it was just a lot of fun, and, you know, and naivety, and, I mean, the interesting thing was, again, this was sort of the catalyst that Larry, it all was because of a guy named Larry Vanover. And I don't know, Warden knows Larry. And Larry was just the Pied Piper. He was a guy that was just a cultural giant. I'd never met anybody like him. Bald hair, big guy, red hair, bald, could play any kind of instrument. Knew a whole bunch of people. You know, Larry's probably 10 years older than me. He must be 65 now, I guess. 67, at the time that was huge. You know, 27 or 25 versus 15. I mean, Larry could take what we thought was garbage and turn it into art. You know, I mean, he stole the wrought iron fence from the old Paradise Cemetery for the railing of his cabin. He was do everything by hand, build an outhouse. He's kind of a philosopher, a musician. His claim to fame was the world's greatest jug band player. And, you know, he played with the greats like Danics and the Hot Licks. And he did these commercials. He was an artist. Did these commercials for Oh Boy Alberto, where he'd bite into the Alberto stick and smoke would come out of his ears. That's when you could get a 15-second sound bite, you know, on a local station for $100 or something. So he was just a guy, and it was the 60s, and everybody was running away from home, and communes were sprouting up, because Larry told all of his buddies, this was the back to the earth movement, you know, move to the simple life, and in Duval, and Larry, being the Pied Piper, kind of brought everybody with him. Now, Duval had a population of 500 people or so, or less, in the city, maybe twice that with the environments surrounding it. It was pretty rough, redneck, out there kind of a place, and for a while, in 1968, 69, there might have been 100 full-time hippies living here. And on a good weekend, during the summer, with the wannabes, the place could have 300 hippies. And an interesting clash of cultures, to say the least. And it was sort of a friendly deal, but it was like people passing, like ships passing in the night, kind of. I mean, the rednecks was, yeah, sticky rotten hippies, you know, and there was all sorts of stories of hippies stealing and growing marijuana. The worst thing was, they'll take off with your daughter, you know, and, which brings up, there was this really ugly old green power wagon, like in 1951, and on the back of it, it said, on the sides it said, rumor control, and on the back it said, don't laugh, your daughter might be in the back, yeah, so, how could you say, there was a lot of things going on. You know, the hippies, of course, thought everybody that lived out here were ignorant or rednecks, you know, and I mean, there was maybe a bit of fear on both sides, too, because, I mean, Charles Manson was sort of doing his thing, and they kind of looked a bit like Chuck, and the hippies sort of thought, they remember seeing Easy Rider and what happened to old Easy there in the last couple minutes of the movie. But at the end of the day, everybody sort of got along. I mean, to some degree, the hippies started a few of these communes. They became cheap labor. Larry drove truck for, like, you know, they needed the cheap labor. And there was a Silver Spoon, which became probably the best restaurant ever in Duval. Sort of, well, like you said, it was sort of like China. It had its glorious moments and times where it would collapse and become a crummy restaurant again. And but anyway, from my perspective, being a kid, 15, 16, and 17, all through the time I left to college, this was the funnest, coolest thing that could have ever happened in your backyard. I mean, we had these, again, Larry brought these pop festivals, not only the Piano Drop, but he organized later that year a thing called the Sky River Rock and Lighter Than Air Fair, which was the first time a bunch of these super bands played in one venue. It was a historic moment, thanks to, again, the energy of Larry and his hippie buddies living east of here. And it was sort of, it came on quick and sort of died quick, too. I mean, by 1971, it was over. 69 was sort of the height of it, I think, out here. The Seattle Pop Festival, I kind of think of it in terms of music venues. And there were some other great ones. There was going to be the music festival down across from your place.
We had two.
Two of them, right.
The Buffalo
One,
Party.
Yeah, the Buffalo
and,
Party.
And the reason they quit by 71 was because all of us from here went to town and got the laws changed.
Exactly. Well, I remember, see, that was heartbroken. They were going to have that one down there on Oldies where that little shed is. You know, they had the stage built. And I knew there were some rotten old bastards in the neighborhood that wrecked it. Those mean neighbors.
Yeah, then there are those mean bulls in the field next to where the Buffalo Party were having their convention. Remember?
Right. So, when I mean, what happened, okay, like a lot of these places sort of had communes too, and they were, like I say, there was a Silver Spoon, and everybody kind of grew stuff for the spoon, and the local hippies didn't have to pay much, but the outsiders paid a lot, and Larry had these fabulous parties where if you were a runaway girl, hell, the doors were wide open. If it was somebody like me, you had to bribe Larry, or you couldn't even come in the door. You know, some things never change. But for me, it was wildly exciting and new, and well, really it wasn't, you know, but I mean, from my perspective, it was, and, you know, it sort of, you know, it, maybe I grew up or the whole movement sort of changed a bit, but I mean, the drug thing got out of control, you know, no longer was just smoking a little pot, and the professors and the intellectuals, bad people started showing up at the party. I mean, if you sort of follow it, you know, I mean, there was, like I say, some great little rock festivals. That one there where the park was kind of an innocent one, the Piano Drop, and the Seattle Pop Festival.
There was a big one over in Woodville.
Yeah,
two out here, and then there was the one over in Woodville.
In Woodville, the Seattle Pop Festival, where, again, somebody got killed there, and, you know, by the, by that summer, they had what was called the Altamont Speedway concert in San Francisco, where they made the mistake of having the Hells Angels sort of be the security, and they started killing people, and all of a sudden, the peace and love and flowers in her hair thing sort of got kicked around pretty hard, and before you knew it, there were disco balls, and the world had shifted again, unfortunately, but for a short period, it was a really fun time in Duval, and to some degree, like an earthquake, is a short, exciting time, and the world kind of looks the same afterwards, but it's never really the same, and you look at people like Kurt Beardsley stuck around, Washington Trout, he bought, you know, McDougal's place, Danny Redmond's still around, Douglas Johnson's still around, I was here before, so I don't really count. I was sort of in it for the long haul anyway. But, yeah, a lot of these guys sort of changed, became part of the culture, the spoon. You know, some of the people disappeared. A lot of the hippies, I remember talking to these guys, and they were all excited. They were the thing to go. Duval's dead. We're going to Tenasket, the new frontier of this thing. And yeah, everybody kind of, you know, ground was cheaper. I mean, those, you know, this is sort of, ran its course, but it was an interesting time in Duval, and our farm was just recently landmarked. I have a place down here in the valley, and it was in its day known as the River Commune, and Douglas Johnson lived there for quite a while, and it was Fern's place.
Yeah, and it was when Walt DeYoung.
Yeah, exactly. Walt DeYoung was leasing the place at the time to the hippies for $100 a month, and
hoped to have a labor-ready force, but yeah. After about 3 or 4 years, that's why he threw them out, because when he was getting hay, and it took 3 crews. One bucket of bales, one in the river, and let's see, and one going down a loaded truck. And anyway, you know, it was, after you started losing heifers down there, and then he decided that it was costing more than they were worth, and that's why he shut them out, and then the house burned too.
Well, it's my understanding from George Gertzman, during a drunken night at the Duval Tavern, he once admitted to me and Larry Vanover that he'd burned one of those houses. I think it was Kermit's, because he just...
That's Kermit's, yeah. That was afterwards.
Right, he just couldn't stand the hippies any longer.
No, but they burned Fern's house.
Yep.
See, it was a lot better house than...
Exactly.
But the hippies, that was about the time when they left, was when that was burned.
Just the only way you could get rid of it.
There were a lot of good people there, but then there was always one oddball.
Well...
In the bunch. That was the problem.
That was exactly it, and that was my point. When you look at these people in retrospect, they were all pretty good kids, college kids. There was probably a couple bad ones there. And the same with the people in the community. They were all pretty good people that lived out here. They all, like I say, I mean, you know, out here it was moonshine and Rainier beer. You know, it was just completely different cultures. And at the end of the day, heck, you know, we all sort of blend to become one group of people. But it was an exciting moment. I loved it. I could hardly wait for the weekends. There was always something exciting happening at Larry's, and all these people were so older and cooler and more exciting than my friends at school. I'm going to the library, Mom and Dad. We'd sneak out to Duval, go to Larry's house.
And you're still here.
Exactly. Oh, I'm going to go to CCD and sing, you know, Brandon's and Bauble. That's why I'm going to be in purgatory a long time. A couple things too. This was such a fun project. We're trying to get a hold of Larry Mano, where he's still around. And he's alive and well someplace out on Kitsap Peninsula. But we're thinking about having a 40th anniversary piano drop in my place this summer.
Is this the year?
Next year.
Next year.
So we've got time to plan it. Country Joe McDonald's still alive. And I suspect it doesn't cost any more now than to have Country Joe play it then, because Country Who and the Fish now. It'd be fun to see him. Anyway, there you go. This is sort of, again, my impression of it, but I think it did have a lasting effect on Duval.
Thank you.
And you just go let them park up there where they're from my barn, and they're not out there. They're not out there in the middle of the night with the matches out by the lock, and so I don't have to put a round over their head like I did after one of the other festivals. I from up in the window to the front. Out the front window, I put a couple of rounds over the head down over the barn and give them to move away from the head mattress down looking at the block.
Local rednecks.
I don't know, they were putting, we had a rock fest.
Yeah, yeah. or some of these are third parties, but everybody got a copy of this, and thank you.
Thank you very, very much. Can we make a wagon wheel of this?
Yes, but I mean, I'm thinking maybe you should redact it a bit before we go public with it. And
thank you. We may.
And yeah, we just kind of take the black marker on some of the, you know, some of the profanity needs to go.
Andy, this wagon wheel is about your landmark.
Ah, thank you.
And so on the back,
people, you said you saw a plane go under the bridge. I saw one going.
I was in the plane that went under the bridge. Was it after the Canada? Oh, way after.
About 3-4 years?
No. This was in a Kristen Eagle, and I was probably 35, so it was 20 years ago. It would have been 1987.
Oh, okay, because about, what, did KJR, weren't they one of the main stations that was pumping it? Well, it was in the mid-70s. It was a Canada, so it was on that anniversary week. I was working down there on the mobile home park down there. The railroad had quit, so I was in a ditch there, digging a drainage ditch that was about ground level. It was a deep ditch. And I looked out there, and this plane circled around two or three. I mean, he came down low, and he was buzzing around, you know, on a nice spring day. And then about the third time, here he comes down, and he, you know, right down by the bend, and he was heading north. Time he made his pass.
See, we came south and.
Oh, well, this one was going from north to the south to north. And he went down, and I saw him coming up over there about Ward's place, which when he had went down, he didn't have any numbers on him. He had a banner on the side because by the third or fourth time he'd come along, I thought, geez, this guy's kind of crazy. And so the last time when he was real low, I looked to see if he, you know, to see what the numbers were on him, and they were covered. Well, then I didn't see him again. Once he went down and went under and came on back up, then he left.
So we'd go up to take off from Harvey, go down to Buzz Van Ness's place until Dowie ran out. Then we'd do like an aerial show for the Van Ness's.
Yeah.
Then we'd cruise down River Road and get real low on the river right in front of Ward's place. And
so you came up through under?
Oh, yeah, and it's a biplane. And I'm in the front, the pilot's in the back, and I'm just scared stiff, you know. I was holding on to the rudder. And, yeah. You have the little headphones on. And Steve says, "Well, do you want to do it upside down or right side up?" Guys, they're just about to puke as it is. You know, I mean, that's huge in a boat. You try that in an airplane, even a little like Kristen Eagle is flying at 100 miles an hour. That thing looks like you're shooting the eye of a needle. Then you go through and go straight up and go into a hammerhead. Steve's dead now. No, we hoped it was a plane crash. Steve's another story.
Well, so there's been two that we know of that have come into there.
Oh, I'm sure a lot of people have.
Have you seen any go under there, Ward?
Well, I haven't, but I just didn't some an army plane go under there during the Second World War.
Pardon? It's a huge bridge.
Yeah. This was the old bridge, though.
No, I'm talking about the new bridge.
Yeah, I haven't seen any. But I heard that an army plane went under there.
A week ago last summer.